It didn't take long for lawmakers to react to Governor Rauner's latest budget address, his second without a state budget in place.
He, you know, on one hand, proposed the same thing, and on the other hand, he's holding up a nice, shiny report that says opposite of what he presented to us today.
These House Dems are just, it was unbelievable. The callous disregard for the future of our state that was on display today in that chamber.
State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill, and Republican State Senator Chapin Rose of Mahomet. I'm Scott Cameron. Today on the 21st, what did you hear from the governor? What did you not hear? 800-222-9455 or tweet us at 21st Show. Plus, fifth grader Shruti Patel plays viola.
It's kind of easy to play, but not that easy. And I have some of my friends that are violas, so it's fun. It just feels really good.
What makes kids choose to take music classes? We'll learn more from a Northwestern University researcher who asked the kids themselves. That's coming up on the 21st after this news. Good morning. This is the 21st. Neither Budu is away today. I'm Scott Cameron. Well, we heard a few more specifics from Governor Rauner yesterday in his budget address. He's open to raising some taxes, but not others. He wants a permanent freeze on property taxes. There was funding for education, social services, transportation, and other areas, but most focused on the next fiscal year. That would leave a big hole for agencies still waiting on funding for the current year. What did you hear from the governor yesterday? Or what did you not hear? Call us at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Sherry Crabb was in Springfield for that budget address yesterday. She spoke with lawmakers afterwards. She is, of course, executive director with the Family Counseling Center in Vienna in southern Illinois. Sherry, welcome back to the 21st. It's nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Scott.
So, you know, we know we've talked before. We've heard some of what your agency has faced here, been hit hard by the budget standoff. You know, you heard the governor, you heard the reaction afterwards. Did you wake up this morning feeling like we're all a little closer to a budget, or did you wake up feeling like, here we go again?
Kind of mixed emotions, I would say. You know, I appreciate what the governor had to say and the language that he used around the needs of our state. But, you know, sadly, without presenting a balanced budget and in a sense throwing it back to our legislators, I think we find ourselves again without direction.
And that's, can you remind our listeners, I mean, without direction, what does that mean? What does that mean to your agency, the Family Counseling Center there? How have you been affected by these, by the budget standoff?
Well, that means 19, 20 months of an inability to fully plan for what the future of our services and future of what our employees and our clients can look for. You know, last fiscal year, we were talking about $700,000 in signed contracts that, you know, we signed with the state. And then without the budget, you know, those specific contracts were in limbo, that we were providing some services in hopes that we were going to get paid. And as the months went on, we found that, you know, that was not going to happen as immediate as we had hoped for. And we had to begin the layoff process and shut down of programs and switching of sites and just completely transforming what our agency looked like in a very short period of time to deal with the uncertainty of what was happening at our state level.
All of that then, I mean, there's a ripple effect to all of that then. If there are layoffs, if there are cuts, if there are contractors that can't be brought in, that is affecting people all across your region. There are people who are not getting services right now.
Yeah, it's not just about the services. It's also about the economic contribution to Illinois that those human service workers have that are employed by agencies like mine. You know, Governor Rauner talks often about wanting to lift up, you know, pro-business type of plans and proposals and agendas. But I think what's often missed is that sometimes, you know, lawmakers, including the governor, may forget that human service providers, we are employers. We are businesses.
And that's, you know, you met with lawmakers yesterday after hearing the governor's address.
Yeah.
That's interesting what you pointed to there, because a lot of times we do focus on the services, on the clients, on the people who are not able to get the help that they need. But there is that flip side that you talked about. There are, everybody we're talking about, all these organizations, including yours, they are employers. Is there a shift in messaging there a little bit as we try to approach now what could be, you know, year two of having no budget in the state?
Yes, I believe that human service providers have begun to shift the language that, you know, in the beginning of the budget impasse, we often talked about the human toll that it was taking and trying to evidence those individuals that we were serving and the impact it was causing from not having access to the services that they desperately needed. And what we found is that that kind of fell upon deaf ears after so long. We still think it's important to tell those specific stories and get those things out there to provide a voice to the clientele and the community members that we serve. However, after so many months, when you go to lawmakers and you try to tell those stories, it's almost as if they're desensitized to what's happening with the clientele. So since, you know, there is major agenda items talking about pro-business and pro-economics, you know, we've got to focus on that. And I'm on the board of Illinois Partners for Human Service, and they've just done that. You know, back in May of 2016, they put out a huge report talking about how human services are an economic engine in our state and really evidencing what we do in the community, not just the services we provide, but the jobs that we do and the economic contribution that each of us have.
Yeah, interesting. So you did meet with lawmakers yesterday. How did those conversations go? What did you talk about? What response did you get from people?
Well, it's the same rhetoric that I heard last year even, that there's a lot of finger pointing. Even after the budget address, you know, it's still that idea of one side's ideas are better than the other. And then there's a lot of pointing to the leadership and saying, well, there's nothing I can do. My hands are untied in a sense. And I cannot tell you how frustrating that is after 19, 20 months of this, that same message has really not changed.
So here you've got a situation where the message that we are providing much-needed services isn't enough. You know, the message shifts to needing to also describe how many jobs and how much of an employment and a bit of an engine in terms of the economy that your agency and others are providing. And you find you still walk away with frustration that the wheels are spinning a little bit here, and you're not seeing the kind of traction that you'd hope to get from the lawmakers that represent your constituents there.
Not as much as I was hoping, but I think that human service providers have a role and we have a responsibility to continue to educate our lawmakers and our leadership on not only what we do, but the economic benefit. And so I think, you know, for any human service provider that's listening right now, you know, we have got to be able to have the same message and show that, yes, we have many different services throughout our state. However, we are one, you know, that we are, in a sense, the mortar that holds the different pillars of our community together, our safety, our education, all those different things that are usually put at the forefront when we talk about budget, as in education, which was talked about a lot yesterday. The human service providers, we help hold up those pillars. We believe that they are extremely important, if not the most important thing in our community. But without effective human service providers being able to deal with some of those issues, the schools, the police departments, the hospitals, they're not going to be able to provide the quality of service they need without those additional resources that they may not provide themselves. And so that's kind of how I see ourselves, is kind of the mortar to the mix of the building of our community.
I think that's the perfect place to leave it then. Sherry Crabb, thank you. Good luck with that. Obviously, people out there are listening and hearing that message right now. Executive Director, Family Counseling Center in Vienna, Illinois. Thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Scott, for lifting up our message.
And let's bring Brian Mackey into this conversation. He's a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. Brian, you know it's a busy week in Springfield when we ask you for help 2 days in a row here.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, welcome back. So the governor's speech yesterday was the main show yesterday, but the actual numbers came out. Some of the things Sherry was talking about there came out later from the budget director, including a line item there, more than $4 billion. It's labeled just working together on grand bargain. Did the governor give any specifics on what he'd like to cut or change to get a balanced budget going forward yesterday?
Yeah, did the governor? No. And I think it's worth pausing on that point for a moment that, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about political norms in Washington, D.C., and a lot of them are being sort of tossed aside. There are also a lot of political norms here in Springfield. And one of those is that before the governor makes his budget presentation, he works with the legislative caucuses, or at least goes to the legislative caucuses, and his staff sits down with their staff. And they have a presentation. They can ask questions of each other. And that kind of has been winding down in recent years. Last year, I understand it was just the top budget person from the legislative caucuses meeting with the budget director. And this year, there was nothing. And so legislators were just as surprised as the rest of us were in public, for the most part, about the specific things that the governor talked about. And the governor avoided talking about a lot of specifics when it comes to his proposal for how to fund state government. And so afterwards, the budget books, which are now just digital files, they don't actually print books anymore, were up online And we began to see some more details about exactly what the administration was proposing.
And I'm guessing neither you nor I have read all 570-odd pages of them, but just in general, I mean, what did he give some direction on taxes, on spending, on some priorities in that document?
He gave some direction. Yeah, not on taxes. Taxes are one of the big question marks. He has, you know, House Speaker Michael Madigan made a kind of an offhand remark 14 months ago about said, where do you think the tax rate should be? And he said, well, you can set it where it was and go up or down from there. It was just an innocuous remark. It wasn't a very specific remark, and it has been come back to haunt him constantly. The Republican Party has made a lot of hay out of that line. And so Governor Rauner has avoided really getting into many specifics about what he would like to see. He did talk about some cuts he wants to make. He wants to make some reductions to pensions. He wants to have state employees and university workers, for full disclosure purposes, including both of us through the University of Illinois, to pay more for their health insurance. He wants to save money through procurement, sell the James R. Thompson Center. These are not new ideas. They've been out there a lot, but they're part of the way that he makes up. You mentioned that $4.5 billion figure for working together on a grand bargain. Ultimately, the deficit, if none of the ideas that he proposed for cuts or this working together idea get passed, we're looking at more than a $7 billion deficit.
And that's just for fiscal 18. That doesn't include...
It doesn't include the current $10, $11 billion backlog of bills. Just add it to that and keep adding to it until we begin to turn the corner on this.
So, you know,
now,
you talk
the
about,
governor...
Go
yeah,
ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say,
the governor did get specific on where... So that's his budget proposal. He did offer finally some specifics on the Senate so-called grand bargain about what he would accept in that. And he kind of poo-pooed the idea of the permanent property tax, the permanent
income
tax increase that's being considered, without also pairing that with a permanent property tax freeze. Democrats see that as a non-starter so far. So maybe there's some room to negotiate if the income tax was again made temporary, because that worked out so well for us in 2011. But maybe we can make that income tax temporary. Maybe the property tax freeze could be temporary. He also said that he did not like the idea of extending the sales tax to include the state sales tax to include food, groceries, and medicine, which currently those things are exempt from the state sales tax. You may notice if you go shopping at a superstore and you buy a shirt and a bag of carrots or something like that, that there will be two different tax rates. The shirt includes the state sales tax. The carrots might only have a local tax on them.
Yeah, and so taxes, it sounds like, it's still that political third rail. I mean, people aren't even talking about taxes. They're talking about revenues. They don't want to use the word taxes. So that's something that we'll continue to kind of see fight over for a while here. You know, one thing that I wanted to come back to, you were talking about before, which gets at some of the conversation that is or is not happening between lawmakers and the administration, you know. And obviously, we want to maintain the focus. We just heard from Sherry and just how important this issue is remain on the policy side. But, you know, so much of getting things done in politics is tied to personal relationships. You know, the governor has now been helping to fund attack ads on Democrats. Yesterday, you saw Democrats labeling with signs that said fake news on some of the governor's messages. The governor was laughed at some point when he said, you know, this isn't about pointing fingers. With that kind of animosity out there right now, I mean, does this give us any sense of how it's affecting the budget crisis if people are not talking to each other?
Well, I think I don't know that. I mean, yesterday's actions and the attack ads is more of a symptom than the cause of that, I think. And I mean, the trust has been in the gutter for a long time. And I think you can trace it back to the campaign. Governor Rauner ran on a message of attacking House Speaker Michael Madigan. He ran on a message of attacking the quote-unquote government union bosses. I mean, for a while, he never made a public appearance without using Speaker Madigan and the politicians he controls. And that's really been an overarching message. Now, he himself has, interestingly, kind of strategically backed away from that in recent months and began talking about compromise and we have to listen to each other. And so he seems to really be going out of his way to portray himself as the more reasonable, humanitarian type figure out there and not the attack dog. Meanwhile, the state Republican Party, which is the benefiting chiefly from his donations and a few of his allies. That's made it a relevant party again in Illinois, a relevant party organization. They are still remaining relentless in their attacks, and that certainly has poisoned the well here. But beyond that, even beyond the personal attacks, there are real ideological differences about the direction of the state. Governor Rauner wants to make some big changes in Illinois that other Republican governors have done, but those Republican governors had Republican legislatures. They didn't have to make those changes with Democratic legislatures in most cases. Yeah. So there's just a clash of what they think is the right policy for Illinois.
And Brian, the impossible question here, and 30 seconds, so what's next in this process?
What I think is next is the Senate senators on both sides of the aisle say they're going to continue working on the grand bargain. Reportedly, Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio came to a Democratic caucus meeting. That's pretty unusual. Usually not even staff or not many staff are allowed in those meetings. So to have a member of the other party come and speak and say we're still committed to working together on this was viewed favorably. So you still have a lot of senators who are hopeful that they can get a deal done. Of course, will it get through House Speaker Michael Madigan? Will it meet Governor Bruce Rauner's requirements? That remains to be seen.
The eternal questions. Well, thank you. I know you've got a busy day today. We will listen out throughout the day for your reporting. There's another at the courthouse in St. Clair County on the lawsuit filed by Attorney General Lisa Madigan, arguing about the state has no authority to pay state workers. So much more on that throughout the day and into the coming days here from Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. Brian, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Talk to you later.
All right. We'll continue a little bit more of this conversation coming up next with somebody from one of the domestic violence agencies. Working with several groups around the Chicago area, one of the agencies that did not get any funding for the stopgap measure. Stay with us. This is the 21st. And welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about why your fire department might need your help, if you can lift a hose, climb a ladder, among other things. But right now, what's the takeaway from the governor's budget address? We're talking with some of the groups most affected by what some have called the slow-motion disaster created by the state budget standoff. Megan Rose is with the Chicago Metropolitan Battered Women's Network. She's on the phone with us from her office. Megan, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on today.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you taking the time. You know, we heard earlier from an agency down in far southern Illinois, provides social services. She had met with some of the lawmakers yesterday after the budget address and really walked away, you know, with a sense of here we go again, you know, spinning our wheels. Things are not moving. I'm curious, after what you heard yesterday, both from the governor and from the reaction from lawmakers and whatnot, what do you think? What did you hear? What's your takeaway from all that went on in Springfield yesterday?
Well, I think the sentiment.
I heard that sigh. I mean, I think that's very telling, isn't it?
Yeah, the sigh is telling. Well, thanks again for having me on. So I work for the Chicago Metropolitan Battered Women's Network, and we're a membership organization. Our members are the approximately 40 agencies that provide services to survivors of domestic and sexual violence throughout the Chicagoland area. And so that heavy sigh is directly in response to what we didn't hear yesterday in the governor's budget address. Illinois is in an unprecedented crisis driven in large part by the governor's insistence to hold on to some of these state, you know, to these non-budget political items that are holding the state budget hostage. And, you know, we're really eager, as a part of the broader human service community, we're really eager for those politics to be put aside and work toward a fully funded state budget with adequate revenue. The domestic violence service community has an additional hardship in that FY17 funding, so for the fiscal year that began July 1st of 2016 and ends June 30th of 2017, domestic violence services were not appropriated any state dollars through the stopgap spending bill that was passed in late June of 2016. So in sum, you know, our agencies have executed contracts with the state. They've been delivering services under those executed contracts with the state and have not received any dollars for providing those services. And, you know, there's, at this point, there are a few bills in the House and in the Senate that would appropriate money to cover that. But, you know, that's just it. They're not, you know, they haven't passed, and we're still awaiting those dollars. And so agencies have been unable to anticipate and plan for the lack of state dollars. And I think that, you know, we're already seeing some agencies deciding not to fill open positions, to place, you know, survivors on waiting lists for services, turning folks away from shelter. So, you know, it's a dire situation. And I think that the other piece that's really challenging is that victims of domestic violence don't just rely on our services to heal and lead safer lives. They rely on other services. And so as that whole
that network
community of human services suffers, so do victims of domestic violence.
And what, I mean, one thing that brings to mind as I hear you talk about that and kind of that community and that network of different providers, you're thinking long term, if that planning isn't there that you were talking about, if
right.
You know, people are now falling through the cracks, I mean, long term, you can imagine the need is going to become so great, there's not going to be a massive influx of cash at some point to rebuild the system all at once.
Exactly.
Long term, so I mean, what are you worried about there?
No, exactly. Thank you for raising that issue. I mean, I think, you know, as agencies, you know, go deeper into survival mode, we may lose infrastructure in the human service arena that will be difficult to rebuild. I think that the anxiety is not only felt by victims, survivors, it's felt by folks for whom this is a career. So if you are a licensed clinical social worker, if you possess credentials that are transferable, you may be electing to move on from this sector and into something that you perceive to be more stable. And so with that loss, you know, is a loss of institutional knowledge and how to deliver the service or relationships with systems that victims depend on in courts or in law enforcement. And so we lose something even bigger, right, when someone decides that this isn't a field that I can, you know, that's stable enough for me to stay in. And so that turnover impairs systemic advocacy. It damages relationships with clients when counselors, you know, move on. And so I think it's a tremendous disservice to, like, the staying power of, you know, the services that we offer the community. So I have really deep concerns around that as well.
And so obviously we're hearing about the effect there in the Chicago area. We talked earlier with Sherry Crabb from Vienna, Illinois, Southern Illinois. You know, the messages are out there. You've been communicating this. You've been talking about the urgency, the importance, the direness of the situation. What would you like to see from lawmakers in Springfield now? And how do you think, is there anything more that needs to be done to communicate that message differently, louder, in some other way?
So I've been in this position with the Battered Women's Network since August of 2015, and this has been the dark cloud that's hung over my work since taking this position, because, you know, we've been without a budget for so long. I think, you know, the same things that we've been saying all along is that some of these, you know, unrelated items, right, such as, you know, just sort of the political pieces that are not critical to passing a budget, by demanding that those go first or be put first or are required before moving forward with a more comprehensive budget solution, we're losing valuable time and we're actually costing the state more money. So I think that, you know, as we've been urging, I think that, you know, a budget has to come first. And some of these other pieces, you know, they can come after, but the longer we go without a budget, the more the people of Illinois are hurt. And I think that, you know, that's apparent. I do wonder, too, you know, I wonder if we have some fundamental challenges in how we think about whose responsibility it is to provide for the most vulnerable people in our communities. I think that that's an interesting conversation, because I get the sense that the government or folks in the government don't feel that urgency or obligation like I believe they should. So I think that that's something I'd really, you know,
A bigger philosophical question.
Yeah.
Emerging from this in terms of the role of government and some of the services. Well, Megan, we heard, you know, I hear your the human argument, the philosophical argument, the economic argument there. We'll obviously continue to have these conversations and talk about what comes next. But I appreciate your time and good luck. I mean, you guys are doing some good work up there, and I appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for elevating our message. Where I sincerely hope that I won't entertain requests for interviews of this nature going forward. So thanks for your attention to the issue.
All right. Thanks, Megan.
Okay, bye-bye.
And another issue facing a lot of communities around the state right now, there's a majority of fire departments across Illinois. They rely on volunteers, at least in part, and lately there are not enough volunteers to go around. Minooka Fire Chief Al Yancey has seen this play out across the state. He's working to recruit more volunteers. He chairs the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association's Volunteer Committee. He's on the line with us now from his station there. Chief, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, you're very welcome. Appreciate the time. Now, there was a recent article that we saw in the Springfield Journal-Register. It described one situation in the community of Loamie of 15 volunteers. Only one was able to respond to a particular fire call that they were documenting, and that one volunteer went out on their own. What is this telling us, or what are the risks when there aren't enough volunteers in some of these communities?
Well, what it tells us is what we've known for a while now is that volunteer firefighter recruitment is decreasing, slowly decreasing, and local communities are struggling to get new volunteers in the door. And it's not just an Illinois problem, not just a problem in that particular area. It's a nationwide problem. The National Volunteer Fire Council has recognized that volunteer firefighter recruitment is declining across the nation.
And what does that look like then? In this one case, you had one volunteer going out on their own. I think it was a brush fire that they were talking about. You know, that person said in the article that, you know, one person can run the gear. I can do this. But that ideally you want more than one, just in case something happens. In case, you know, not having enough volunteers, it's not just an inconvenience in some cases. I mean, there's a safety issue.
Yeah, it's very much a safety issue for the community. It's a safety issue for that department. One volunteer firefighter, one firefighter cannot fight a house fire on his own. A lot of those communities rely on mutual aid, automatic mutual aid, which brings several departments. That's becoming something more popular in today's fire service, that fire departments are bringing more fire departments initially on the call so that they can assemble more firefighters to combat whatever the emergency is at that time. But it definitely is an issue that volunteer, you know, when you're the only one to show up waiting for someone else to show up, it's a critical time. And so, a lot of them are relying on mutual aid and auto aid to bring more firefighters to bear on that emergency.
Yeah. You know, can we just define terms a little bit here? Because a lot of people may not be directly familiar with this. So, Chief, when we say volunteer firefighter, what does that mean? Is that person trained, compensated? How many hours are they volunteering? How does the process work?
Typically, a volunteer firefighter is just that. A lot of communities will pay a reimbursement for some kind of a small stipend or something like that for their time, whether it be a training, whether it be response to calls. But it's a very minimal amount of money. It's something intended to cover their gas money, to cover some of the expenses they have to volunteer in that department. But as far as the hour commitment, it really is with each organization as to what they require. But a volunteer firefighter to be safe and efficient on an incident requires many, many hours of initial training to be able to get to the point of really being able to effectively respond. So a lot of these people who are doing this are doing it on their free time. They're coming into the fire department on a training night, spending a couple of hours doing air pack training, doing pump operations training, and they're doing that on their free time, maybe picking up a little bit of reimbursement, basically, for their gas money to get there, or those kind of things, for a little bit of commitment. But it's definitely a commitment of volunteerism and not a money-making venture for a volunteer.
In some of these communities, I mean, these are many of them are smaller communities. You know, Springfield has its own full-time staff, and Champaign-Urbana, Chicago, obviously, and many others around the state. Is it a financial issue for many of these communities? Is it just too expensive to hire full-time firefighters?
You know, yes, that's a lot of it, because these are, again, small towns. These are small towns, and the idea of hiring full-time firefighters, they just cannot afford that. We're talking about many departments around the state that we talk about small communities, either small community fire departments protecting people of probably less than 10,000 people in their community, or probably even smaller than that. So these are small budget departments that have a responsibility to protect the local community, and the funds that they do collect goes towards purchase of quality equipment, fire apparatus, gear for their people. So there's really just not a funding base there to support paying full-time firefighters.
And there's a long history in this country of volunteer fire departments, you know, that goes way, way back. You know, one thing, there was one chief, Troy Johnson, also told the paper there that, you know, it's hard to get volunteers. People are too busy. You know, 7 years ago, he said when he first started, he had a full roster of people. Many of them decided, you know, maybe they were too old and dropped out for other reasons, had older kids. You know, what's changed right now, and what are you doing right now to confront some of those changes, to bring more people back into volunteer firefighting?
Well, that is a lot of it. It's the time demands, as we talked about, the training requirements, those two things combined. It's a lot of time demand on people. People have a lot of things going on with their kids in sporting activities, two-income families, time demands. All of those things go towards the issue of not having time to be on the department and just pulled in many different directions. One of the things we're doing through the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association and the Volunteer Committee is we received a SAFER grant from FEMA, which is a recruitment and retention grant. And what we do is provide workshops around the state to help educate local fire department leadership on more effective ways to recruit volunteer firefighters and to look at different ways to do that so that you can structure your recruitment to get people in that you need. Another part of it is expressing the need in your community. A lot of people expect that when they dial 911 that the fire department is going to be there, or they'll be there with enough people. All those things will occur like they would expect, but the fire department needs to get out there and explain the need. We explain the need of we are a volunteer department. We need people to help in our department for various things. And part of what we train the leadership is look for different ways to use people in their community. Not everyone wants to be a structural firefighter. Someone may be able to drive the truck. Someone may be interested in being part of your water rescue team. Someone else may be just wanting to be a part of helping with administrative tasks around the firehouse. Those kind of things helps the leadership, the fire chief and the leadership of the organization say, how can we get people in here to help in the various aspects of what goes on in a fire department?
So a lot of opportunities out there. And I would just, excuse me, sorry, we're just about out of time, Chief. But we will post up onto our site and tweet out to folks sort of more information about how they can find out about how to get involved with some of these, the links to your organization and others. But thank you very much. A big need out there. People hopefully hearing this and didn't realize there was an opportunity like that. Chief Al Yancey, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, stay with us. I'm Scott Cameron. You're listening to The 21st. This is The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. Nyla Boodoo is away today. You know, we know already there are all sorts of benefits to playing music as a child. Most kids have to take music classes in school, at least through grade school or so. But after that, when it becomes their choice to take those music classes, most of them quit. There's all sorts of reasons for this, and researchers at Northwestern University looked into this by asking some of the kids themselves. One of our producers visited Leal Elementary School in Urbana also to hear from the kids themselves to find out why some fifth graders there signed up for an elective music class.
Knees slap. Hey, everybody. One, two, ready, go. Chicken on the
My name is Agustia Pawate, and I am 10 years old, and I play the viola. I've been playing since, like, September or October. I can't remember, but I've been playing it for a long time, and I've already gotten pretty good at it. I thought that the violin was too high-pitched, and the cello was too low-pitched, and the viola is right in the middle. So that's why I decided to play it. Miss Gingle, my teacher, she gives me so many new assignments. That's why I think it's so fun. Like, and she likes about how I learn all these songs so fast, you know.
Can you do that?
I can do that.
Now she can do it. Beautiful. That's what we need. So, cellos, you have the option of playing the melody part or the slaps.
My name is Luna Morales. I like our teacher, Miss Gingle. She's very nice, and she's really fun, and we do a lot of fun things. I want to keep trying to play the cello. We can do it as a group and make it sound better. I feel like you can play something really nice now.
Okay, ready, cellos. One, two, ready, D. D, slap, A, slap.
I'm Elisa Thangmanarankit. I'm in fifth grade. I'm 10 years old. I started viola this year, but I've played piano for 5 or 6 years. I like that it's fun, and I like to make music, and it's very pretty. I like recitals and getting to show off. I play in front of my parents and my sisters, and we also get to play in front of people who also take the same lessons as me.
Well, it's fun because we do it with our friends.
Yeah.
And you get to make more friends.
When you put your bows to the string, use your power finger, right? Captain Fred or Captain Luna or whatever. You're Captain Fred. You're going to push it down. So did you see the stick moving to the hairs? You're impressive. As opposed to this.
My name's Shruti Patel. I wanted to be in strings since fourth grade. I guess I wanted to play viola because it was just the thing that I wanted to do. It's kind of easy to play, but not that easy. And I have some of my friends that are violas, so it's fun. It just feels really good.
That's it. That was really, really good. That was really good. You got it.
One group of students in the area, fifth grade students, are at Leela Elementary in Urbana, who are choosing to continue to take music classes, additional music classes there, thanks to producer Haula Delahi for that postcard. Steve Demarest is a professor of music education at Northwestern's Beenan School of Music. He worked on the study I mentioned just a moment ago, looking into why some kids keep taking music classes while others don't. He's on the line now from his office. Steve, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like a fun class. I think they're doing it right there.
It was great.
You know,
it was great. I'm hearing their responses and going, yep, that's one of our variables. Nope, that's not. Yep, that's one.
Well, that's what I want. It was like a check. I mean, I heard early on the one student, I think it was Augustia, said, he likes the way he's been taking it for a long time now. He's been taking it since October or September. Another girl a little bit later on said she liked it. She got to kind of show off. You know, is that one of the reasons kids do take classes? Just they feel that they're getting good at it. They feel like this is something that they're special at, and that it pushes them to keep going?
Yeah. I mean, what we call sort of positive musical self-concept, what some other researchers call self-efficacy, the belief that you're good or can get better. Absolutely. That was one of our strongest variables in predicting this. And then you heard other kids say, I like it because my friends are in it, and peers, peer influence was another one of the variables.
Interesting. So friends, maybe family members, being around music kind of inspires you to go.
Variable. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I cut you off. What was the strongest?
For the first part of our study, which we were looking at what kinds of things might best predict whether they continue in music, having a family member involved in music of any kind was like the strongest predictor.
Interesting. And that could be it could be a brother, a sister, it could be a parent, just somebody in the household who plays music.
Distinguish. Yeah, anybody. And it could be any kind of music as well. It doesn't have to be, the same music as they're doing in school.
Interesting. Do you have any takeaway from that? Is that just because they're inspired by it? They see it? Is it any?
Well, it's a good question, and we can't really quite dig into that. Like the girl that you had on there who said she plays piano, played piano before she started strings, and that she likes to show off for her family. You parents who have their kids take piano lessons are probably likely somebody in the family has had some sort of, you know, musical engagement that mm-hmm. led them to even think that that was a good idea. And so I think it's probably a little bit the culture of the family. Like, music is something you can do. It's one of your options,
yeah.
along with soccer and, you know, whatever else, right?
Yeah, the other menu of things that
exactly
that people can do these days. You know, one thing, there are a lot of assumptions, I think, and I'll only speak for myself because I don't want to, you know, speak generally about anybody else. But, you know, I would think that, so if a kid likes music, if, you know, they like to listen to music on the radio or listen to, they're just sort of surrounding themselves by music, that that's going to mean they're more likely to want to play music and to continue to choose to play music. That's not what you found.
Well, right. It is a bit complicated that way. So one of the things we measured was sort of their attitude toward music. But another thing we measured was their attitude toward themselves as a musician, what we're calling musical self-concept. And both of those were higher for kids who chose to go on in music, but the attitude toward music was not a significant predictor of their choice. So it sort of, in when you put all the variables together, it kind of fell out as an important predictor.
Interesting.
So it isn't. And this is sort of what we had said earlier, you know, and sort of our rationale for doing this study is that students may opt out not because they lack interest, but because they lack, you know, that there's some self-perceived inadequacy.
How do you mean?
Musician.
That they're not very good?
They like it, but they think they're not talented. For example, talent is a word that's, as to me as a music educator, I'm becoming more and more
cringing at.
I'm becoming more and more disenchanted with that word, and unfortunately we music teachers use it a lot, but I think that it suggests, you know, talent versus skill or whatever sort of suggests it's something you possess or don't possess rather than something you can develop or not develop. And I think it's really, really, really about what you can develop.
And what, essentially that's what stood out so much, that it's sort of that the idea of that self-concept. When do kids start to develop that concept?
Yeah, that is a great question. So we measured in this district, elementary school went through sixth grade before they switched, even before they went to elective music. So clearly our sixth graders had a pretty strong formation. This is one of the studies we're planning right now.
Hmm.
We want to look at kids as much as we can, like even back to first grade. It's a little bit trickier to ask them questions, you know, but we want to go all the way back and see, you know, at what point do they start to sort of compare themselves to other kids, and at what point do they, you know, what kind of attributions do they make? Like, I think with young children, for example, other studies have shown they're more likely to believe that they can get better at something
mm-hmm.
when they're younger, and as they get older, they start to think that their abilities are a little bit more fixed, what's called attributions of success or failure. So I really want to look at the attributions as it crosses over with this musical self-concept. You know, at what point does a child perhaps develop an idea that they have a certain amount of this fixed quality called talent that's either going to keep them from getting better or not? Because as soon as you think that, as soon as you think you can only get so good, that's when you start to
locked
make
into something.
Yep.
You know, so
yep.
And just one, the Hala who produced that story did just chat into the chat room here that all the students that were on, that we heard in that did have a family member who played music. So just one more interesting little tidbit. I didn't realize that before. But, you know, just very briefly, because I know we're focused primarily on sort of what you've learned from this study and whatnot, but just as somebody who is so immersed in music, can you remind, you know, people just what is the value of playing music, of being exposed to music at a young age?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of things out there about music makes you smarter, music makes you better at language, music makes you this, music makes you that. And I mean, I don't know how true some of that is. There's definitely been questions raised about those connections. I do think that our brains are very interconnected. And so certainly being able to develop, for instance, the capacity for fine-grained pitch perception or fine motor perception is probably going to benefit you in more than just the thing you're doing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody here at Northwestern, Nina Krause, does a lot of work with, you know, with sort of looking at young children's music study and how that might affect, for instance, their ability to process certain linguistic information. For me, as a music teacher, as a musician, it's really more about the opportunity to develop yourself, your sense of self, your expression. there are researchers looking at things like it feels good to synchronize with other people. So like young children who are involved in musical activities maybe express a little different level of empathy and things like that, but it's not about empathy per se, but about being connected to a group of people.
Yeah, and understanding in a different way as opposed to sitting there and doing whatever goes on the rest of the day in a class. There is a different connection there. You are joining in literally and figuratively harmonizing with other people to create something new.
Exactly, and that harmony is both pitch and rhythm. That is, you're also in synchrony as well as in harmony. And that seems to be sort of powerful for people's sense of connection and people's sense of belonging. And I think that, you know, I think there's more work to be done in that area, and that's one of the things that we're interested in looking at as well. But what I really want is for kids who are interested in doing this to not sort of self-select out because somebody else gave them the idea they're not good, that they can't get better. For me as an educator, it's really about kids having choices. I don't think that music I'm a choir director, so I'm more interesting. But, you know, I don't think choir is necessarily everybody's jam, right? That's okay. But I don't want kids to not do it because they think they're not good enough or because they think they can't get better. So that's, for me, it's more about I would like to see young children's choices and sense that they have choices maintained as long as possible. I think that's really vital to a good education.
And, you know, I mean, one thing that comes to mind, you talk about choir. That's something that anybody can do. Other things, you know, we heard of a viola player, you know, other people play instruments. That can be expensive. You know, they have to get the instruments, you know, whether you rent them or whatnot. And, I mean, there are other obstacles that confront people when they want to, even if they really do want to continue playing with music. Are there tools? Are there, you know, have you seen any of that crop up and see any sort of advice for folks in that area?
Yeah, well, there from a research standpoint, when you look at studies that talk about kids choosing to participate in instrumental music, all of a sudden things like socioeconomic status pop up more than they do in vocal music for this very reason, the cost of participating. On the other hand, you also get that once parents make the investment, they maybe push a little harder to have their kids stay in it, right? There's not a cost to dropping out of choir. You still get to keep your voice, but you know, if they bought a trumpet or paid for all these lessons, they're like, oh, you should keep this going a little while longer because we've invested a lot.
You made an investment, yeah.
I think that it's one of those things again where there are certainly challenges, but I think most responsible instrumental music teachers and responsible schools will bend over backwards to provide a kid with what they need. If they really want to do this, there are school instruments in a lot of schools. I'm not as familiar in the Chicago area, but I lived in Seattle for a number of years, and there were several organizations where people donated their instruments. So there was this sort of instrument bank where kids could come and check them out, you know, and use them. And so I think that those things are actually surmountable. But people don't think that they are. Right?
Maybe aren't aware of some of the
exactly. The first thing you get is like the sheet of paper saying, "Okay, here's where you can go to rent your instrument," and you go, "Oh crap, I can't afford to rent an instrument." But it's important to just be able to, you know, go and talk to the teacher and not feel bad because I mean it is expensive, and you know, the biggest thing is you know figuring out a way, and I think the teacher will work with you figuring out a way to get that kid in there if that's what they want to do.
Well, so we're talking about
that should not be a barrier. I would hope.
Yeah, or find a way over it. Well, this is one survey, a little over 300 sixth graders from 5 elementary schools, but it sounds like there's a lot more still to learn. Steve Demarest, Northwestern University, will get a tweet out some more information about this study at 21st Show on Twitter. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. So you've been listening to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Thank you for bearing with the B-Team host here as we kind of wrap up our show here. More information on yesterday's budget address from the governor and reaction, which we talked about earlier, at websites all over the state for your public media station right here. Thanks for listening. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.